That's Mayor Weatherall.
Oh, Mayor Weatherall, okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Senate Committee on Health and Human Services will come to order, and we are very, very happy to be here this beautiful day. I'm Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I live in Springfield. My district covers parts of Eugene. Cresswell goes around. Lowell goes, includes Brownsville. Sotaville goes around up in toward Lebanon, includes Cresswell. So it's a rural-urban district, which I really enjoy the combination. I've been chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, or a health committee in the Senate for the last two sessions, and before that I was in the House on the Health Committee with Senator Cruz, who was the chair. Senator Cruz is now the vice chair, and he should be here any moment. Senator Berger.
Well, I'm Joanne Berger, and I believe I know everybody in the room. my district is District 5, and it goes from Coos Bay to Lincoln City. It's the most beautiful Senate district, obviously, in the United States. And I am delighted to be here today and so appreciative of the senators that are going to be listening to you and keep you from having to drive all the way to the Capitol to tell them about your concerns. And I can assure you that those concerns are going to be taken extremely seriously. Mm-hmm. I attended the education field trip last week up in Reedsport, and Senator Walker went back and immediately drafted some amendments to some legislation as a result of that meeting. And so I hope that everyone will feel really comfortable in being very forthright and honest, and thank you for the gorgeous weather to impress our visitors. So,
Senator Mona Sanderson.
I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. It's the conservative part of Multnomah County, but we're sort of called a swing district, so sometimes Democrats win, sometimes Republicans win. I'm a nurse, and healthcare has been my passion most of my professional life. And then I've served on the health committees with Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz. And I must say that when I was in the House, one of the first bonds I made was with your Senator Joanne Berger. We had so much in common, and we're really, I think, a support group. At least she was for me. I'm happy to be here. Again, I love coming to the various parts of the state. We were in actually my district last Friday, and we learned a whole lot about the needs for our children, Head Start, and how the buildings are really falling apart in our child developmental centers. And so there's a lot of need that the state has, and I'm very anxious to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. We've had our health committee, we've had a meeting at the hospital at Newport and also at the hospital at Florence. In 2 weeks, our Senate Preparedness Committee, of which Senator Berger is the co-chair, will be meeting, I believe, in Tillamook, and then we will meet in Lincoln City. So I've pretty well covered the coast over the last couple of years in terms of meetings. I have an affinity to the coast for some reason. I've been involved in rural health. I did propose the bill that was somewhat controversial about the tsunami warning system. In fact, one of our neighboring communities, the mayor took a chainsaw to the sign out on the highway and was concerned that it would be bad for business if we scared people away. The coast is a very important area for a variety of reasons. It's one of the fastest growing areas. Much of the coast, I think, is considered rural, although there are pockets, and I think this area is kind of a center for health care. Is that correct?
It is.
A provider center.
It is. Medical center.
Yeah, it's a medical center. And so the coastal area is continuing to grow. It's, some of the land prices are out of sight, and some of the problems are going to be zoning problems, building in safe places. It's a wonderful visitor tourist place to come, and I think that's really, really important for the economy of the coast. So it's an area that I think has some wonderful assets, and we have to plan for not only, you know, the safe development, but to make sure that if and, well, not if, when something happens, that we do have a plan for recovery and so on. Now, this big event may not happen for another 100 years, but it could happen tomorrow. So we have to be prudent and plan, and I think healthcare in all its forms, and we're going to talk a little bit about the mental health center later on, is extremely important that we provide adequate health care for not only the residents but for the visitors. And so that's one of the reasons why we're here. That is why we're here. So I just want to thank Bonnie Brown and Maggie Gardner for the help in setting it up, and Andy Easton for being here. Thank you very much. So would Mayor McGowan and Mayor Witherall please come to the table, and
good afternoon. I apologize for my attire. I do have a mayor costume, and if I would have remembered to put it on this morning, I would have worn it. But it's dress down day at Kingsview Christian School, so I dress it down today, and I apologize. Welcome, senators and committee administrator, to, as Mrs. Berger put it well, the most beautiful district in the state of Oregon. I would like to make one correction, however, is that we did not put on this special day for you. This is how it is every day in Coos County. And, so if you can get that in mind. I have.
Would you introduce your name before the?
Oh, my name is Rick Weatherall. I'm the mayor of North Bend, Oregon. Okay, and we're a tad conservative too. Yeah, I understand. But I've been in education. This is my 43rd year in education in Coos County, and I worked my all the way down from teacher to administrator, and because teaching is the only occupation where you start at the top and work down, and so I am down to administrator now at Kingsview Christian School. Senate Bill 37 excites me in the idea that it will help the love of my life, the young people of not only Coos County but of the state of Oregon and elsewhere also. I have seen so much in 43 years, and of young people without health care, without any information, with parents who are either indifferent or unable to make those connections for their children. And we have people, I have young people in junior high who had never been to a dentist, never been to an eye doctor, any of those particular things. And if we can do something to solve that particular problem. Now engaged in the Christian school, the Christian parents I deal with are oftentimes adopting children with special needs. You got to love those Christians, and I do. But and so they come, and I've seen a whole vast new approach to things with this new assignment that I'm in, and that they have these children who have these special needs and don't quite know where to go. You know, they're not in a metropolitan area where they have access to clinics and Dornbecker's and Sacred Hearts even and things of that nature. And if this bill, which I see it as an opportunity to link rural Oregon with the things that do exist in our state so they can take advantage of that. And I would hope it would just be a beginning place where they can expand it and make something good. And conservative as we are, I think health care is something every American deserves to have. And I would fight to death to make that possible for everyone. And we know it's not. And when you're in the school system, you realize that it is not true. And so I would just speak out today in the support of Measure 37, just for that fact, is that we in rural Oregon need a connection. Obviously, we may not ever have the facilities that are available in metropolitan areas, but we need access and information and the ability for our parents who are raising their children to have a place to go when they have that need. And basically that's all I have to say about the situation, but it is a dire, dire need, especially in our community. And I salute you for bringing this to us, and I salute the Senate and eventually the House for taking action on this bill that will make this a better state than it is right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. I'm Jeff McEwen, Mayor of Coos Bay, and I would like to welcome you and your committee. It's an opportunity for us to show off our community. We're very proud of our communities. We're very proud, frankly, that you're here and that you take the time to visit us. I think getting out, seeing rural Oregon, I know Rick and I have a hard time calling ourselves rural, but in reality we are, and I think your willingness to get out and travel makes a big difference in terms of what you're doing in Salem. So thank you for that. Thank you, Senator Berger. I know that you're a big part of why the committee's here, and we're lucky to have you representing us. As I said, we're very proud of our communities. We're very optimistic about our future. But we have a problem, like much of the rest of the state and, frankly, the rest of the nation, in that there's a lot of people, unfortunately, and children especially suffer, that are uninsured. Dan Smith, I think, will speak to you later, the director of our Bay Area Hospital. He can speak from a more technical aspect of this, but I believe they create a load on our healthcare system, perhaps, that is as a result of them not being able to very effectively access healthcare. They may not use the most efficient means simply because the emergency room may be the only way they have to get to healthcare. And I think that your efforts, I'm sure, are daunting as to how to deal with those issues. But we applaud you. We will do our part, and that is we think that creating jobs that provide health insurance is important. That certainly is an effort that our partners in North Bend, at the Port of Coos Bay, with the South Coast Development Council, at the state, are working hard. I think we're fortunate in the South Coast to have a governor that has given the South Coast some priority in terms of helping us with our economy and with our projects down here. There was an interesting article this morning on the Dow Jones Wire Service, and it talked about the union's willingness to address unconventional methods of dealing with health care in the auto industry and the steel industry. I believe that that's what you'll have to do in your committee. I believe you'll have to be somewhat unconventional in your approach. You have a big task ahead of you. And we want to help where we can. It won't be an easy fix, but we admire you taking on this responsibility and taking on this task, and we thank you. We're glad you're here. Take a minute, if you would, to look beneath the surface at the beauty of the area. I hope you have a little bit of time. It's a beautiful day, as Rick says. It's always a beautiful day here on the South Coast. And we're very glad you're here, and thank you both for coming here and also undertaking the task that you're undertaking. We appreciate it.
And probably you don't know whether you're sitting in North Bend or Coos Bay right now.
I think we're right in.
It doesn't matter.
No.
And that's the point we're talking about here today, is that our children and our community and the health of our community is our number one goal. And I would echo what Mayor McEwen has said about helping us, and that's how we are. And I'm glad to hear him voice that opinion. And welcome to the Bay Area.
Thanks. So, see, I'm Rick, are we in North Bend or Coos Bay? I'm not sure.
I think,
either.
I don't know.
Well,
we're pretty close.
Yeah,
you're pretty close.
Yeah, I go through that in my area. I'm from Springfield and that,
okay.
that other city.
That city to the west.
But I like the motto that Eugene has adopted. Eugene is now the gateway to Gateway. Gateway is our area, and they keep sending things over to us.
Okay.
So, like the hospital and Sony and Symantec and all those places.
Perfect.
Thank you.
I wanted to follow up a little bit with what Mayor McEwen.
McEwen, yes.
McEwen said regarding children and health care for all kids. Right now, the House is in negotiations. I just actually was speaking with Speaker Minnis. Speaker Merkley twice this morning already regarding the Healthy Kids program, and they are in negotiations with the Republicans, and because the bill originated in the Senate, they made another bill, mirror image of that. We have been working on it in the interim, and they are in negotiations, and I am cautiously optimistic that the final form is going to be able to provide health care for all kids with an emphasis on rural areas and making sure that we can develop good access for kids in the rural areas. So knock on wood, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Good. Thank you.
I also want to mention that I'm a member of the Health Care Reform Committee. I'm concerned that when Bill Murray is here, and he's going to be speaking in a little while, I'm concerned that when Senator Westland and Senator Bates, both of whom are from quote-unquote rural Oregon, are planning their new, we are planning a new kind of health care, universal health care, that we consult with the local areas, particularly the rural areas, and make sure that all of the current providers are involved, and we have to define who the providers are. We don't include everybody currently there. We marginalize some providers, and anything that we come up with will only work if we base it on the existing system, I mean the provider system. Now, you guys have to tell us, you know, give us your input, because who's going to run the program? How, you know, is the money going to be distributed? Where is the money going to come from? And it's essential that we get input from rural Oregon. So that's another reason why I'm very concerned about this, because we tend to talk, you know, the Archimedes principle is floating around up there somewhere. We're up at the 50,000-foot level talking about this plan, but we have no idea how to implement it. So my suggestion is let's start from the bottom and work up, or let's do it simultaneously. So that's another reason why I'm here, and I want to hear about the mental health center. That's a provider group, and that's closing, or is that risk at closing? I noticed in the paper today when I are. Paper that I picked up this morning, and so these are some extremely critical areas, and there's a huge cost shift from that program to your emergency room, and those are the things that we really need to look at. So anyway,
just one more thought, along with what you're saying, those types of closings also place not just a load on the emergency room, but also on our police, our fire, our services in our community. I read an interesting piece, and this was a little bit of time ago, but it was analyzing the cost of living in Coos County. And we were relatively low in terms of cost of living, with one exception, and one exception was health care. Health care, we were well above the national average in terms of cost of health care. And that is, I believe, and again, Dan Smith can speak to this, much more efficiently, but I believe that's because we have such a large number of uninsured in our community, and they place a drain on the rest of the community and on our medical professionals here. So it's rural Oregon is unique. Here we are. We should be low cost of living, yet in reality our medical care is very high. Rural Oregon is a different beast. You're correct. But again, thank you very much for taking the time to come down here. We know it's an effort.
Appreciate you.
Thanks. Okay, Dan Smith and Bob Moore, would you please both come up? Welcome both of you to our committee. Thank you. Dan, would you?
Yes. I'd like to echo the previous thanks.
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dan Smith, CEO of Bay Area Hospital, Coos Bay.
Go ahead.
I'd like to echo the thanks for you taking the time to come down and have a conversation with us. I've traveled to Salem from time to time to offer input and testimony, and it's wonderful to have you all make this effort to come down. I've had an excellent introduction by my friends already, so they provided a great lead-in for a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. One is I actually wanted to cover three things, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Bay Area Hospital and also the kind of the healthcare infrastructure in this end of the state. I'd also like to speak to you briefly about a couple of issues that keep me awake at night. One is physician recruitment and retention, especially in a rural setting, and also a bit about uncompensated care. And, of course, there's also already been a little bit of conversation about that. And I think I have some facts and figures that might really drive the point home. First of all, Bay Area Hospital is licensed for 172 beds, and we have about 127 set up and staffed. We are a health district. There are 17 of those in the state of Oregon. We are surrounded by four other health districts, Bannon, Coquille, Reedsport, and also our friends down in Curry County at Gold Beach. We all collaborate. In fact, Bannon, Coquille, and Bay Area Hospital have an alliance, and we actually formally collaborate on helping each other provide services to our communities. We have 1,050 employees, approximately, and we have 135 members of our active medical staff. Bay Area Hospital provides about $45 million a year in salaries and wages to our community and about another $15 million in benefits. And most of those benefit dollars, I think, are spent here as well. So we are an economic engine, if you will, for this community. And obviously our mission is to take care of our community's health needs, but also we recognize our great responsibility as a very important part of our infrastructure here economically as well. And personally, I'm involved in economic development area because I believe that's part of our responsibility as well. Secondly, I want to talk to you briefly about the recruitment retention issues that we face. They have been exacerbated the last two or three years. Previous to that, our major clinics here in Coos Bay North Bend area have done an excellent job of recruiting outstanding physicians, and they're still doing that, but it's becoming more and more difficult. One specific area that I'd like to speak to is the rural malpractice subsidy. And actually, I have a letter that I brought copies for all of you from the CEO of one of our major medical clinics in town. And he's on the front line of that. And so he asked me to bring this letter and provide it to you so that he could provide that information directly to you as well. From my perspective, we have four outstanding OB providers in our community right now. We've had four for the last several years. We went down to three recently. And quite frankly, that was because of that young man's fear of what might happen to he and his family as his malpractice coverage ratcheted up as he had additional years in practice. Mm-hmm. The way the insurance for those folks works is they start out at a relatively low level, and then with each year it ratchets up, and right now, three out of the four practitioners in our area, their premiums on an annual basis are approaching $100,000. So we lost this one excellent practitioner. Luckily, we were able to recruit a replacement after several months. But that particular subsidy is critical in rural areas, especially ours. And quite frankly, the hospital has also stepped up to the plate and has offered a small subsidy to these clinicians as well to try to keep the excellent service that we have here in our region. We see this as a regional responsibility as well as a responsibility specific to Coos Bay North.
Have you been involved in the reinsurance program using state money for medical malpractice insurance for these kinds of doctors to keep them in?
That information would probably be contained in this letter.
But
the hospital hasn't directly.
Pardon me?
The hospital hasn't directly been involved with that.
Well, but do they receive assistance?
Yes, they do.
They do.
Okay, they do.
Good.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And that's very important.
Okay, good.
For all of us. The third thing is uncompensated care. To key off what Mr. McEwen was saying, uncompensated care is becoming more and more of a problem, and of course it's an urban problem as well as a rural problem, but I think it's exacerbated in the rural areas because we are often smaller independent facilities. We often aren't parts of systems or corporate entities, and so therefore we don't have the resources that sometimes they do to help offset some of these shortfalls. To give you specifics, Over 50% of all the pediatric patients that pass through our emergency department are either on the Oregon Health Plan or have been. And obviously, if they're no longer on the Oregon Health Plan, because, as you know, it's been shrinking, then they often end up as charity care. And to give you some specifics just for our hospital, our charity care in fiscal year 2004 was $2.5 million. In fiscal year 2005, it was $5 million. In fiscal year 2006, it was $6 million. And we're a little over halfway through this fiscal year, and extrapolating out what we've had so far, we're going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $7.5 to $8 million in fiscal year 07. So this is obviously a very steep curve. And, you know, we care for everyone in our communities regardless of ability to pay. That isn't the question. It's just that obviously we have to cost shift to recover those losses. So,
but I know. The Ontario hospital was in rough shape. They have one patient, $1 million of uncompensated care.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they're hurting. I think that is excellent information for us to have. I mean, we've got to somehow deal with that. That's terrible.
Right. I really think it puts it in perspective.
We will lose our hospitals.
But on a positive note, when you come out to talk to us, we tell you about our problems. But on a positive note, there are five hospitals in southwestern Oregon and five medical staffs that collaborate and provide exceptional care for our communities.
Yeah.
And we're going to keep doing that.
I know. But it's hard to maintain the staffing, as you've already mentioned, and it's simply hard to continue to have escalating costs of uncompensated care. That's the major.
Anytime, I'd be glad to have you call me or email me or any questions or whatever.
Well, we'll be dealing. Andy will help us with this issue.
Again, thank you.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
And if we do get some good changes in health care delivery legislation passed this session, we'll definitely want to be working with the communities on implementation. So we will need your feedback.
That's much appreciated. I really appreciated the comments about coming out and asking us to be involved with that process, because we're doing a lot of things that you may not know about already to try to help some of the, especially the younger people in our communities. And I think even just an inventory of that might be really enlightening for you.
That is exactly the kind of information we need, and that's what I've been trying to gather for our healthcare reform committee with Senator Cruz on, is an inventory of healthcare providers. I had a visit from Jim Thompson, who is the director of the Pharmacists Association. He has a bill that kind of boggles my mind. The bill is to recognize pharmacists as health care providers.
I think we're going to end up being co-sponsors.
I know. We are. And I said, Jim, that's interesting, because one of the things I've been talking about is who are the health care providers? Mm-hmm. I mean, we know the doctors and the nurses and so on and so forth, but there are so many others that provide care, and unless we identify them and somehow integrate them into this universal plan, you know, we're not going to be any further ahead. But
absolutely,
yeah. So that's something that we need to find out from the various areas. Thank you.
Thank you, senators, for hearing us out here in our community today. My name is Robert Moore. I'm the director of Housing and Emergency Services for Oregon Coast Community Action. We're one of the largest nonprofit social service providers in Coos and Curry counties, about 135 employees, about $7 million a year business. And my work is primarily in the emergency services field, so I have actually three specific healthcare issues that I'd like to bring before you. Two of them, at least, certainly would fit into the Senate Bill 37. The last one that I will mention is a little bit different. But I guess I can segue right into what Deanne was talking about for uninsured medical care. We have a very small program called MedNet that provides care to those without medical insurance, and it's a very unique community-based program that I think you'll appreciate. It's funded 100% by payroll deductions from the local Longshoremen's Union. Oh. They've been doing this for a number of years, and in the last calendar year, 2006, we were able to assist 263 unduplicated individuals through that program with a, you know, like a one-time fill a prescription, a visit to a dentist, or a visit to a doctor. Now, since our flow of funds is limited by what the longshoremen put into it, I can tell you that we also had to turn away an enormous number of people as our funds ran down. But we've been operating this program for a number of years. The longshoremen have been very consistent in supporting that. And at this point in time, they've donated out of their own pockets between $250,000 and $300,000 to this effort. Be happy to give you the demographic sheet that shows who we worked with in that. And it certainly raises a different picture of how some of the uninsured medical services are provided, because obviously the doctors and specifically the dentists who are seeing these people are writing off a major part of their costs. We only pay up to $60. A typical dental procedure might be $100, $150, $200. The local dentists that we work with have agreed to accept that $60 payment and write off the rest. So there's a real partnership that's happening there that I think is very important. And then there are some ancillary pieces to this that I think are also very concerning to us. I had staff come to me today and report an incident of an elderly person who was needed oxygen as a medical life support, whose utility bill went unpaid, and that the electric company was going to shut off their electricity, even though they were able to prove that they needed, you know, the electricity to keep their medical life support going. And we were able to forestall that, but we were alarmed to find out that the Public Utility Commission apparently has written rules in such a way that utilities can now do this. So I think that's very concerning to me, and this just happened just minutes before I came over today, so I'm not able to – I don't have any documentation on that right now, but I could probably give you more at a future point. The second issue that I wanted to discuss with you also fits in with some of the concerns of the hospital, and that, and also your concern, Senator Morissette, with the potential closure of the Devereaux Center. Our agency has been working for a number of years with the homeless mentally ill, and we do that in a partnership with Coos County Mental Health. We provide housing and housing stabilization services, and mental health provides the professional mental health services. We have just started this very week, actually on Wednesday, the planning process for our 10-year plan to end homelessness. And one of the features of that plan is going to be how we are going to better serve the population of chronically homeless, i.e. the mentally ill. And certainly Bay Area Hospital is going to be a major partner with us in that, and we're hoping that we will be able to come up with some community-based planning that will be able to chip away. Notice I said chip away. I didn't even say make a dent. Chip away at the enormous amount of cost that the hospital is bearing. But we feel that, and based on my own personal experience of supervising our caseload, I can tell you that we're very frustrated to see the revolving door, the enormous cost to the community in the jail system, in the hospitals, in the social services system, and it just goes around and around. And our coordinator from the Interagency Council on the Homeless likes to tell about Million Dollar Murray, who was a chronically homeless man in Reno, Nevada, and they actually did a study of the cost to the community of Million Dollar Murray, and it was $1 million. And at the end of that $1 million, he was still on the street and homeless. So obviously that system is not working, and it's a waste of money, and we have to figure out a different way of doing it. And I can tell you we're trying to build that partnership in the community to come up with some better models of providing those services, but clearly we're going to need some state help.
That's excellent. Looking at new ways of doing things, because some of the old ways don't work.
Clearly not.
Yeah.
Clearly not. And then the third issue that I wanted to raise, and the one that doesn't really directly relate to Senate Bill 37, is a concern that I have. One of my responsibilities is I'm the supervisor of the CASA programs for Coosa and Curry counties. And if you're not familiar with CASA, that's the court-appointed special advocates that work with abused and neglected children. And of urgent concern to us is the current movement within the Department of Human Services to institute what they are calling a safety model, which is actually, for them, a new way of doing business around the issues of abuse and neglect. And I'd like to read for the record today a letter written by one of our CASA volunteers who also happens to be a PhD and has a lot of experience in working on health systems issues. This is a brief email, although she has extensive testimony that she provided for the OARs that were written on the safety model. Becky and Twyla, I'm working on written comments on the DHS safety model due to DHS by Wednesday. This was written January 28th. As I began to piece together the issues, I came to the conclusion that the perfect storm for Oregon's abused and neglected kids is about to hit our shores. First, the DHS safety model is slated for implementation in March with no pilot testing, minimal partner input, a brand new comprehensive procedure manual that hasn't been field tested, a partially trained workforce, substantial resistance from branch personnel.
That all sounds familiar.
It does.
Yeah.
I'm preaching to the choir.
It happens all the time. But we will take a look at that, right?
Keep going here.
And unknown mechanisms for monitoring the impact of these changes on Oregon's health and welfare. Second, 32 of the 36 Oregon counties are facing substantial budget cuts. Coos County, for example, is in the process of slashing law enforcement, jails, probation, health, et cetera. All of the community safety net that is supposed to detect, respond to, and prosecute child abuse, as well as providing preventive services to at-risk children and families. Third, DHS has proposed a major restructuring of branch personnel and plans to implement a new information system as well. This scenario has all the elements of a perfect storm where multiple individual threats suddenly coalesce into a much bigger risk than anyone realized. But I didn't see it coming. There's nothing to increase survival odds. So I share Sharon's concerns.
I met with the CASA representative about 2 months ago, and she talked of this type of thing that was happening. And I have had some conversations with Ramona Foley, who runs that particular program. And I will have more conversations, and I'd like to have a copy of that.
Yes, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Something that
this includes
she was concerned, the CASA representative I've talked to.
This includes Ms. Comden's submittal to the committee that was putting together the OARs on this and some of her direct testimony and recommendation.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like the full thing because we've had a work group on dependency and looking at these and other issues. We've been meeting for almost 2 years now with the department, with the Justice Department, with the appellate court, with all major players, and in our meetings with DHS, and basically, this is certainly a piece of it, and I know something about how they're trying to restructure, but amazingly enough, I don't know a thing about the safety model.
Well, and I guess...
And I find that really, really interesting, and I think... I've just... Mr. Chair, I'll give a call to Mickey Cerise Monday and say, Mickey, come and explain this to me.
So we'll get copies of this for the committee. Senator Berger.
Thank you. That's one of the things I wanted to say, Mr. Chair. If the administrative assistant would provide those copies to all members of the committee, I would appreciate it.
Yeah.
The other thing is I wanted today just recognize the professional work that you've done, Bob Moore, over the years for community action. Coming today is great, but I want to know that you are one of the most consistent people as a voice for community action in this community for years, and we greatly appreciate that. I want to ask one question. I had visitors in my office this week from Lane County, and they were giving me a statistic about 12% of Lane County veterans are homeless. Do you have any idea of how many homeless, chronically homeless, people we may have who are veterans in our area?
No, we don't, but I'm glad you raised that issue. Part of the planning process that I mentioned earlier around creating our 10-year plan, one of the first functions of that planning committee will be to do a formal count of the homeless. Now, we've done the one-night shelter count since 1987, but that only counts the people who are actually sheltered and doesn't give you the true picture. So as we're moving ahead here in 2007 with our 10-year planning process, our first step will be to conduct a formal survey and try to get the very number that you're looking for.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You know, they told me about programs, buildings, affordable housing in Lane County, and they had two small projects, but they've both been extremely successful. And so I was very interested, and it caught my attention. I think it's just terrible to think that people go and protect us so that we are able to work and live in peace, and that they come home and live under the bridge or on the streets. And so I'm really interested in affordable housing for veterans. So as you move along with your plan, I would appreciate it if you would stay in touch with me.
We'll definitely take note of that and work on it. Thank you, Senator Berger.
Yes.
Just a question, curiosity, Mr. Moore. How closely does your organization mirror the service matrix of UCAN?
Very closely. Okay. UCAN's a sister agency,
and I'm on their board.
Oh, great!
So, yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity of speaking with you.
Okay. We're
10 after 8 already.
We're moving right along.
Mr. Chair, would you like for Senator Cruz to tell a little bit about
who yes, Senator he Cruz, is? Tell us a little bit about yourself, but not too much. Just the good stuff.
I was born at a very young age. Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which includes the major portion of Douglas County, some of Jackson and Josephine, all of Curry County and the part of Coos County that Senator Berger doesn't have. Been involved in health care for, I think, since before electricity.
That's right. Yeah.
And I apologize for being late. I made the monumental error of going into the office before I left Salem this morning. And I didn't get out before other people started coming in the building. So I'm very pleased to be here. It's an exciting day for me. Tonight is the sweetheart dance, and I have a hot date with my six-year-old, and this is the tie she told me to wear. So
that's an improvement over the other one. That you he and I both have an identical Rush Limbaugh tie that I scandalized my Democratic friends with once. Anyway,
good. Thank you. Okay, we have a number of people to speak before lunch and some after. So, Jim, why don't you and Andy come up and briefly give us some information as long as we're on the hospitals. Andy, would you come up, please, and introduce yourself as far as your role is concerned?
Good morning. You did.
Good.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. I'm Andy Easton, Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And we want to say thank you for letting us have a piece of this committee hearing today and testifying in front of you. And if there's anything we can do in the future to help you on health care issues, please let us know.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Andy. Mm-hmm. Jim?
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee. I'm Jim Watson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Southern Coos Health District in beautiful Bandon by the Sea. I'm also Chairman of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and a past chair for the Oregon Rural Health Association. On behalf of Oregon's 57 acute care community hospitals, our healthcare systems and the patients we serve, I appreciate the opportunity to testify before the committee this morning. In particular, we certainly appreciate the committee's continuing interest in healthcare challenges that we're facing here in Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 37, which will dedicate a percentage of current tobacco tax revenues to rural safety net programs and services. 36 of Oregon's hospitals are designated as rural hospitals. They are the cornerstone for a viable rural safety net program in our great state. They maintain inpatient services, diagnostic support capabilities, and emergency services, all of which are available 24 hours a day. Certainly, our urban hospitals in Oregon face many challenges, but these same challenges are amplified in the rural setting. Maintaining a viable community hospital is essential for recruiting and retaining rural doctors and other medical specialists and medical professionals who work in our hospitals, for meeting the basic health care needs of your constituents, as well as for assuring substantial support for the local economy in each of the communities that we serve. Our association actively supports state actions to maintain quality rural health services. Senate Bill 37 will dedicate an additional roughly 3.5% of existing tobacco tax revenues from the general fund to rural safety net programs and to the Rural Health Viability Grant Program, which I was fortunate to testify on two sessions ago when that was passed into law. The grant fund assists the smallest and most rural community hospitals in modernizing or replacing aging facilities. Most of those facilities were first built and funded with federal Hill-Burton grant programs back in the 1950s and the early 1960s. They're getting old. And it would please me to no end to see, after 4 years, that fund finally get some appropriations.
It would please Senator Cruz to introduce that bill to see it finally get some.
Absolutely.
The funds that would be made available to this grant program would assist these hospitals in preserving and improving access to health care services in their communities. A second piece of Senate Bill 37 dedicates some funds for the Rural Health Care Revolving Account. These funds would be dispersed at the discretion of the Office of Rural Health. Lastly, I've been asked to point out to the committee that before this bill passes out, a reference to the Rural Health Care Revolving Account may need to be clarified by an amendment, since the passage cited as a reference does not exist. And that is a reference to ORS 323.455, subparagraph 4, subparagraphs C, D, and E. And our staff will make sure that either committee counsel or assistants receive the proper information.
You want to note to Mother Andy?
Yes, please.
Okay. Come see me Monday morning. We'll do it.
Yeah, we're going to hear this bill on Monday. We're going to have a public hearing in the Capitol.
I'm not able to get that. Mr. Chair, quick enough.
Yeah, okay.
First thing.
Go ahead.
And I would just like to support the things that Dan Smith said. They're important to all of us here on the South Coast. Particularly those of us who are in smaller rural communities. We try very hard to have a very positive impact upon our communities, and I think we do in terms of the health services that we provide and in terms of the economic impact. I didn't know Dan's was so large. If I program that out in my old microeconomics language, I think his impact upon the local economy in Coos Bay and North Bend probably exceeds $250 million. But I'm pleased to say that we come proportionately close in our own community, where we contribute over $25 million in economic impact to our local community. So we're very critical to the communities that we serve. Thank you very much for coming here. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to know, you have three hospitals. And the hospital in Bandon Dunes, is the recruitment and retention of physicians and medical staff as great as any other hospital? How does it compare? Because I know that at least in Bandon Dunes, that's sort of a recruitment area for, I mean, it has that beautiful golf course, so it may have a better draw than, say, Bay Area or Bay Area Hospital.
Chairman Morissette, Senator Montesanderson. Never mention better draw to a golfer. It has bad connotations.
No, there's no good draw.
We're fortunate in Bandon to have a world-class destination golf resort adjacent to our community. And certainly there will be times where that will be the focal point of attraction for a medical professional. I think that 90% of a medical professional's decision-making in terms of relocation of a practice to a rural community is based upon the quality of the hospital, the facilities, the personnel, the services that you have to offer, the quality of what is being provided in the community by the hospital. What is the community receiving in added value in terms of community health education and other services that are outside the building and out in the community? And then also, just as important for the people that we look to bring into Bandon, the schools and the other community services, they're all critical to the decision-making of a medical professional in bringing a practice and a family into the community.
Yes.
Mr.
Chair? Yes.
Yes, I have a question about the recruitment of physicians in rural areas, because in our area we have had a number of doctors who have come from with backgrounds in other countries. And I'm curious about the standards that are set up. In other words, are the standards the same as for those that are educated in the United States? And what is drawing so many foreign doctors to rural areas?
Chairman Morissette, Senator Verger. There's a shortage of doctors willing to come to rural communities in the United States. As a result, recruiting efforts have gone to foreign medical graduates, almost all of whom have received their training, their internships and residencies in the United States. These are the people that we look to when we're not successful in bringing an American citizen into practice in our communities. It's happening all over the United States. The most recent physician to come into the community abandoned is a wonderful gentleman with a young family who has come to us from Peru. And we are currently recruiting for other medical professionals to come into our community because of losing a couple of physicians to retirement and moving out of the community, and because we're growing. And we need those professionals there so that the residents that we serve as a health district do not have to go 30 miles away to find a primary care physician to take care of them and their families.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
My concern is certainly not the foreign background. It's just the standards. In other words, they are put to the same standards, if I understand your answer, that any other doctor is. If they've interned and they've had their residency in this country, then it's the same as any United States citizen.
Chairman Morissette, Senator Berger. I apologize because I didn't really answer your question the first time around. And, yes, the standards are the same. And when we look at those individuals as hospitals, we go through a credentialing mechanism which looks at each individual, their training, their skills. And that investigation and assurance is what leads us to provide them with privileges for treating patients in our hospitals. And all of them are applied to the same standards, yes.
I'd just like to make a comment that I think that's important for people to know, because some of the doctors who are coming speak English, but it's not fluent English. And I think that that might be of concern to patients that go to those doctors, that they have exactly the same ability to treat you, even though there is a difference in the language.
That's very true.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nikki, would you, we're running kind of close to lunch. Kevin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Nikki Witte, Coos County Commissioner. And I believe you have a packet from Coos County that starts off with our proposed budget cuts to date. I'd like to introduce Commissioner Kevin Stufflebean. Kevin was recently elected, and after he was elected, but before he took office, and it was illegal for us to talk to each other without posting a public meeting, we met, we asked for a meeting with Dan Smith, from Bay Area Hospital, and said, in the Bay Area, we have Bay Area Hospital, we have Waterfall Clinic, that's a private nonprofit organization, and we have Coos County Public Health. And how, actually, we thought probably we weren't going to have a public health department this next fiscal year. And so our conversation with Dan was, how can we get together, figure out who does what best, and instead of doing maybe part of a job in two different places, meaning that Waterfall Clinic and public health, maybe work together and have really good services. And so we haven't, Dan suggested we get everybody together and have a meeting, and we intend to do that. But I just want you to know that we're really trying hard because we know how important public health is. If you look at these cuts, public health is about in the middle of the page, and we propose removing about $474,000 of general fund money. Last year, the contribution, or this current fiscal year, the general fund contribution to public health was slightly over $600,000. And I want to call your attention to the items at the bottom of this sheet, because while it looks like we're pretty close to being balanced, we're far, far apart still. This sheet proposes we use some one-time revenue sources. It doesn't include any provision for our unappropriated ending balance. And Senator Morissette and Senator Cruz will know from their home counties, we've been getting this money early in October. Now we'll get no money till the end of November when property taxes start coming in. And so our unappropriated balance needs to be increased to make sure we have enough the beginning of the year. Because of the bumping process, some of these positions may actually be refilled by an employee that has more longevity or more certifications. So while we think this is the cut for a particular position, actually it could be far less. We have 7 labor agreements in Coos County. All of those labor agreements need to be negotiated this year. And we didn't include anything yet for inflation. The second handout I have, it's an executive summary from our comprehensive plan. And I'd like, Frances Smith is here. She's our Coos County Public Health Administrator. If you have any questions, maybe she could come up later. I gave you this because in the program, state support to public health, as you know, is 59 cents per capita. In Coos County, that's not even enough to pay for half a nurse. And so it's very difficult when we try to run some of these programs, like communicable disease, very small amount comes through. Even if you just take the TB cases, we've spent your money the first month of the fiscal year, and yet we have to follow up with those people every month. So it's very, we want to do it, but it's very expensive for us to do it. And then I won't go into the part. They have some high concerns about a number of different issues. I'll just let you read the rest of that when you have a chance. The next handout is the proposed budget for fiscal year 07-08. And it's contingent on a number of potential funding sources. Hopefully, the funding sources that are on this sheet that come from the state, hopefully you'll be able to support those, because if any of these go by the wayside, that'll mean changes that we'll have to make. We're very lucky to have Frances running the health department, and Cheryl Lorenzo runs all the bookkeeping. I'm sure you know how bureaucratic and cumbersome the reporting requirements are. And I don't think that's the state's fault. I think it's the federal government requires it, and so the state has to mandate that too. But it requires more than one full-time person to keep all these things straight. And in order to balance this budget, we have assume some general fund contribution, and we have also, they're using all their Title 19 money, so there will be none of that money left next year to help balance their budget. The next handout is the organizational chart for public health, and it shows the positions that will be in the budget next year, the ones that are lined out in yellow on your copy will no longer be there. Public health gave us a narrative about state mandates relating to public health, and so I included those for you because sometimes maybe you don't come across all those mandates, and as you look through it, if something doesn't make sense to you, maybe we could eliminate it. The next handout is a summary showing the difference in our discretionary general fund on the first page, what our budget was this year with the safety net, and what it'll be like next year without the safety net. And to back that up, it shows the funding that comes to us by every department. For example, the assessor's office. I was in Salem last Friday testifying before House Revenue about assessment and taxation. We collect approximately $52 million in Coos County for all the taxing districts. Because our permanent property tax rate is so low, 4 of the 5 counties in our Association of Oregon Counties region have the lowest permanent property tax rates in the entire state of Oregon, and that's Coos, Curry, Douglas, and Josephine County. But anyway, we collect this $52 million, and we get to keep about 7.6% of it. Everything else goes somewhere else, and yet we pay almost 70% of the cost. And so we say, we'll try and throw in ideas how you might help us. I know the legislature is looking very favorably at an increase in the recording fee for affordable housing or worker housing. I believe in raising fees where it's directly related to how you're going to use the money. And I think the document recording fees should be dramatically increased to help pay for the costs of assessment and taxation, or each taxing district should pay their fair share of the total cost. I didn't have anything else. Then, if you'll flip over to the next page, the district attorney's department is the same. This district attorney, of course, is your employee, an elected official, and yet the county picks up almost $1 million for the assistants and the clerical staff. I do know there's a bill in for the medical examiner's office, I believe it's in the office of state police, to fully fund autopsy reimbursements. We spend over $21,000 a year on autopsies, and we get two from the state. And in Lane County, the state pays your deputy medical examiner, but yet they don't contribute anything to ours. And so I wondered if that could be something that could be considered. Also, you've been hearing in your two home counties, I know, and in our county, how the cuts are affecting public safety. If you look at the next handout, it shows you where the discretionary funding is spent, and you can see that law enforcement-related departments get by far the most contribution.
What I think would be helpful, if you could write us a one-page, two-page letter highlighting suggestions that you have.
Oh, okay.
And we can use this then as a reference or background,
okay.
But I think you've mentioned some interesting things,
okay.
Or some things that we need to look at.
And we have four more short things for public health. Do you want me to?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure. And then to summarize it on.
Okay.
Yeah, good. Go ahead.
We wonder if there would be an opportunity to negotiate the deliverables required in our contract with Department of Human Services. Many times it's a standard contract that DHS uses with every county, and the deliverables are the same regardless of the size and the amount of the state contribution or funding. And then I think I mentioned the administrative fees for communicable disease are inadequate, and we would really appreciate an increase there. And last, we wonder if you'd look at, and we don't know if this would work, creating a base amount of state general fund support for public health that would be enough to run a bare bones program, and then looking at doing something extra based on population.
And Chair Morissette, that's where I was going to step
go ahead
in.
And introduce
yourself. Is Kevin Stuffelbein, Commissioner for Coos County. One of the issues Commissioner Whitty brought up, that we received 2% for support, but that only equals to $36,000 for our public health. Coos County was one of the counties that took over the local public health authority in the early 20s, and just the mere thought of us having to return that authority back to the state has been a very difficult decision, and we've done everything we can to try to retain our authority as we have right now. But definitely one of the functions that we need is to look at how we can receive more funding and state support. And we know there's some recommendations to actually double what we're receiving right now. And still, even at $120,000, that still doesn't buy too many nurses to deal with the public health issues we have. Public health is a critical component of the healthcare systems in our counties. It's completely preventative, and it completely assists the hospitals and tries to keep those people from creating such high costs at that level. So to lose that and to return that back to the state will be a severe detriment to our county specifically. So anything that we can do to try to increase some of that funding will be a big help for us. And we're actually, the only reason we've got our budget put together as we do now is we're anticipating that there will be some increases in state support for our public health. So we've kind of factored that into that. So if that doesn't pan out, then we know we have to kind of go back to the drawing board and look at other issues to still maintain that. The other issue that we have is around our mental health. We actually would, over the years, especially the last 4 to 5 years with some of the reductions the state of Oregon has taken, we've lost a lot of our support for prevention dollars around A&D issues, and that's becoming a critical factor for our county also. And we definitely need to see an increase in the amount of A&D prevention, intervention, and treatment dollars, and we know that treatment's a critical component. And, you know, we know it starts down in, at the teenage age with cigarettes and alcohol, and we're now moving it up into the meth arena, but we definitely need to try to target and prevent as much as we can at a younger, earlier age. And with the reductions we've taken at the state level, it's been very difficult for us to provide those prevention, intervention, and treatment at the county level.
Okay. Now, have you factored in the loss of money from the federal timber receipts?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have.
You have?
Yeah.
Okay. And so a lot of the cuts are going to be in these service areas that you're talking
right.
about.
Yeah. Right. And some of and the mental health section side of it receives no additional funding from the timber dollars that we'll be losing. So just even when we factor in over the last 4 years with the cuts we've taken, it's still pretty minor that we're looking at. One of the things that we wanted to point out is although it has a great impact on the child welfare system in our county, we've actually had to lay off 7.5 staff members in our juvenile department. So we, effective February 19th, will no longer be processing any of the petitions, summons, witnesses list, any of the subpoenas, and all the additional work that's required for child welfare in order to present those cases before the judge. And we just notified them yesterday that that would be happening. I actually sent an email up to Marge Reinhart and Ramona Foley to let them know that that would be happening because that's going to put a drastic impact back on them.
Now, do we
say we're not, we'd like them to pay for it.
Do we have that sheet?
No, you don't.
Okay.
I can get a copy.
Well, no, and I think what you, again, get us some summary information based on
right.
what you're talking about.
I'll send it up. To, and then one big factor that impacts our county and has now for several years is our Medicaid brokerage systems that has been passed. That's been very detrimental to our community and has not been a benefit. It's actually really kind of destroyed some of the abilities that we had in the human services field to provide transportation and get people to the necessary appointments that they needed. I know there was just a report that was commissioned last month that went to Deputy Director Clyde Psyche with the department that kind of laid out all the information on how it specifically impacted Coos County. And we're hoping that we see some changes in that because I know it's been kind of a will and the desire of the legislators to move that brokerage system across the entire state. And just we're hoping that that report demonstrates how negatively it's impacted our county and how it will impact others. And I know
Senator, you're going to get us a copy of that report.
I can send that copy to you. And I know, Senator, for your district, that brokerages is looking to be rolled out in the next year there. So.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I find this appalling. I really do. And I know exactly, I mean, when, especially when you don't have a tax base, your county has been hit huge. And when I take a look at the services that you've given, I mean, communicable disease, you actually investigated 314 reports.
Mm-hmm.
So if that isn't happening, it's going to be a bigger burden on the health system because those have to be investigated so we can stop the spread. I look at your four TB cases. I look at the immunizations, the 1,200, over 1,200 shots for children. See, I was a public health nurse.
Yeah.
That's what I did. I made the home visits. I, you know, was a clinic nurse in the family planning clinic. But I do not know if you turn the authority over to the state, what does that mean? What's the result of that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, we don't know that yet.
The state's the one that gets sued at that point.
We don't want to turn it back. We think it's something that needs to be provided locally. And thank you for acknowledging our financial problems, but of all the counties that federal timber money affects, we're not in the worst shape. Curry County may go bankrupt. Josephine County will have, their assessor told us last Friday, they have 70,000 people in Josephine County, far bigger than Coos. They're going to be left with two road patrols sharing one car in the sheriff's office.
Yeah. Sarah Morris and Senator Anderson. Actually, Dr. Allen is very much aware of our situation down here, and she's been in contact with our local public health. And it's been made clear that if we do turn it back, there's going to be very minimal level of service provided to the residents in Coos County. As they said, they're understaffed and don't have the staff to deal with it, and it's going to take a long period of time from somebody from Salem to Portland to get down here to deal with situations. So we know that that's a critical issue, and that's one of the – and I know I contacted our local representatives locally just so they were aware, because it's not something that we want to do. It's something when it comes down to the bottom line with the dollar that we have to look at every option. So we're trying very hard to maintain what we have and – keep it going. So we're still working on those components.
Mr. Chair, may I just say one short?
Sure.
Several years ago when Senator Hannon was still in the legislature, we had something come through our office that said Department of Human Services spent $300,000 a year transporting people to Eugene for a methadone pill. Mm-hmm. And I called Senator Hannon and I said, would you give us the $300,000 and let us have our nurse practitioner dispense the medication? And he said he hated the program and was going to do away with it, but he didn't. And so we'd make that offer to you if it's still there. It seems silly to transport them.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that, but we can check it out. But the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, which I'm on, will be, you know, discussing these issues, and that's a point to do that. But it is appalling. It is appalling.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
And that program still exists, and basically they can go to whichever doctor they want, no matter where they are, and we pay for the transportation. It still exists. It's a travesty. Couple things, Mr. Chair. First of all, I know of at least two distinct funding streams that are going to be going to treatment. They're positive moves, and I also know that there's going to be an additional funding stream to the DA's office to deal with dependency issues.
Right.
And so there is, I think, some positive movement. But my question, and by the way, Kevin, I still have that email. I haven't deleted it. It's still there, okay? I just don't know how to respond at this point.
You did, remember.
Okay. I've got reports from two other counties at this point on the rework of Jefferson Behavioral, and I've been kind of told that you guys think you can fix it and just to back away, and since you're here.
I don't actually think, Senator Cruz, that we're going to back away.
Us to back away, because I was going to disband the darn thing and because it wasn't working. It hasn't worked for a long time. And counties weren't getting the money at the appropriate time. I mean, it was just a disaster. But I understand now that the commissioners have taken direct oversight that we think it's going to straighten itself out.
We hope.
Okay.
We're willing to give it a chance.
Okay.
Would you mention Curry County for just a moment, what you told me earlier?
Curry County has a permanent tax rate of 59 cents. And if you bought a $365,000 home in Curry County, I think your tax bill is $101. They're going out for a local option levy. It would only last 5 years. It would, your tax, property taxes to the county would be five times the size they are.
Only $500 for a 300.
That's true. It doesn't do anything to help the funds lost in the road department. It's to backfill general funds only, and they're going in May, which traditionally has a very low turnout. So,
but no, I want to know what the next step is if it does. What
they have sent a letter to the attorney general, asking him what is the process if we can't continue.
As a county. Okay.
See, no, you'd think that they would either come with us or they would go with Josephine. They're both bad choices because we're all in the same boat.
You just add more to your debt.
Right.
Too,
yeah.
Now, there is another program that I will mention that is a possible source of funding for alcohol, drug, mental health treatment, and that is the alcohol recovery fee, which we have talked about for years and years and years, and I'm hoping that we get some traction on that.
Recovery fee? Is that another word for tax?
That is a euphemism. Yes, and there are Republicans who have sworn they would never support a tax who are supporting the recovery fee, and I'll tell you who they are later.
Okay.
But it's critical because alcohol, drugs, mental health are intertwined. It is a huge cost shift from a small amount for treatment to a huge amount for emergency rooms, jails, prisons, broken homes, and so on. And I think that's something that we need to look at, but it is atrocious that we don't put the money at the front end of some of these programs. We put them into the back end, and it costs, well, you know what it costs.
Right.
It costs a fortune in human lives and human misery and families and so on. Now, I again, if you can summarize some of these things, and
okay.
then we can refer to the material, but we, you know, be specific and... And we will follow through on, in different ways.
Okay.
And when the Ways and Means Subcommittee deals with this on health, you know, I will, and you should be there to testify as well. I don't know the possibilities of moving funds around, but it's going to come right down to some nitty-gritty decisions that we have to make.
Did you say you wanted to know about that mental health center at the Nancy Devereaux Center?
It was in the paper today, and it's going to close, and it relies on grants and an employ 25 people, and you're down to 15
right.
or whatever, and that's a huge hole in your community, and that's going to be a cost shift.
Coos County Mental Health used to be able to support programs at the Nancy Devereaux Center, and then the state changed the outcomes it wanted through mental health's grant,
mm-hmm.
and it had to be the money that was going to them in the past had to be redirected to supportive employment programs only. And we stayed out there. The mental health director and I were out there all day a couple of years
okay,
ago.
Okay, that was not, I don't think that was in the paper. I mean,
I just wanted to tell you.
Well, no, what I want to know, the article in the paper was very vague. Nobody really wanted to
okay.
talk about the real problem.
Okay.
And what I was wondering is what the real problem is, and if, you know, if there's this, if the state regs are part of the problem,
okay.
we need to know that.
Mr. Chair, they kind of spoke to that earlier in the fact that the state silos money in ways that don't apply in rural communities, and so there's money there that they can't touch because they can't achieve the outcomes
right.
that the state thinks they should.
We need to address that.
Yeah,
that's an
a
issue.
Big problem.
That is an oversight issue, and we can address those issues.
Great. That would really help us.
Okay, good.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one quick question?
Yes.
And that is on the OLCC shared revenues. You're seeing a growth in that to the county. Is that correct?
12%.
Projected 12%.
Projected.
We're cutting it to 11.
Yeah.
For cities and counties.
And so does that go directly into your mental health program?
Yes, it does, Senator.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the funding streams for,
well,
for treatment.
Well, League of Oregon Cities has an amendment to exempt this. They have an amendment. We have to hear that bill again. We're going to hear it again, and the amendment doesn't sound too bad. It's a city amendment. We'll deal with that. But there is an additional 2% that will go to the cities and the
right.
counties.
I like the bill the way it's...
Well, we'll
thank
see.
You.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, we should probably break for lunch because we're... Kathy, are you shaking your head yes or no? Okay, let's do that, and then we'll come back, and we'll continue the hearing. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm hoping we can all leave about.
Okay.
Or close.
Where is she? She is.
What? Okay. Okay, we're going to come back to our information. Bill Murray, would you come up, please? And Chris Fleming.
Mr. Chair, be careful. Mr. Murray is nothing but trouble.
I know. I've known that for quite a while. Welcome, Bill.
Well, thank you, Chair Morissette, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here today. My name is Bill Murray. I'm actually CEO of Doctors of the Oregon Coast South, or DOCS for short. We are the fully capitated health plan that operates in Coos County and contracts with the state to administer the Oregon health plan in our community. I did bring with me a couple handouts here that I'll be referring to. What I'd like to do today is give you a very brief profile of our plan and what we do in our community, and spend mainly some time on what we do in addition to what you might traditionally think that a health plan would do. And I think that is really the key success to our organization, and I think that's going to be the key success to whatever shape or form healthcare takes as we move forward. So as your committee and other committees look at healthcare and what to do with healthcare, I think it's important for us to look at where we have been successful and to use those as the building blocks to move to a new system of healthcare that's sustainable, affordable, and available to all of us. You have in front of you a profile for our plan that operates in Coos County. You can see that we have about 7,000 members, and most of those members are actually children that account for about 50% of our population, and then seniors and those that are disabled count for another 30%. And so 80% is comprised of children or the elderly or disabled that's currently covered under the Oregon Health Plan. As you know, the standard benefit plan has seen significant reductions over the past couple of years associated with the state's budget reductions. So we have very few standard individuals anymore, which is reflected in those high numbers with regards to children and seniors and disabled. You can see that our population here is primarily English-speaking, although we do have an ever-growing number of Spanish-speaking people enrolled in the plan in our community. As referred to earlier, we are considered to be a rural plan, and I don't think that says anything positive or negative about us, but it's just simply where we're situated. And I think healthcare can be delivered in both settings economically as long as the community is committed to delivering healthcare to its citizens. One of the important factors that we track is access to health care, and we measure that by the number of Oregon Health Plan residents that we have per primary care physician that operates in our plan or participates in our plan. Right now we're at just about 150 Oregon Health Plan members per primary care physician in our community, and that number still remains a positive number from us from the standpoint that each physician or provider, primary care provider that participates in our plan, agrees to accept up to 200 members. So we do have a fair amount of access still available. Now, what's unique about that is that a number of these physicians that still have open slots, per se, for Oregon Health Plan members are closed to all other members in our community. They aren't accepting commercial. They aren't accepting Medicare, but because of our plan and participating in our plan, they have agreed to keep open slots for Oregon Health Plan members. It's a positive for our community at this point in time. It's a juggling act every day to keep providers in and participating, and we've been very lucky in our community to have very widespread participation. Nearly every physician and generally most healthcare providers in our community participate, and that's based on the premise that if we all do a little, we can make this work for everybody. And so we've heard discussions about cost shifting, and that does happen in the system, but what we're trying to do is cost shift equally amongst everybody and not overburden any one group at this point in time. It's an issue, it's a growing issue, but we've been able to keep the plan afloat in Coos County because everybody does their fair share. On the second page of the handout I gave you.
Just a moment. Key success factors, nearly 100% provider participation, everyone does their share. The question that I've been asking is who are the providers? And I would like to have you give me a list of who you consider to be your providers. And I'm wondering, in looking at a reform program, are there people who are not typically thought of as providers being, you know, are they really providers? And if we do a new plan, are they going to be included? So I'm interested in the provider list.
I think we all think of providers as the traditional role of you go and see somebody and they say do something or don't do something or you need this or you need that. Healthcare, as we've come to know it, is much more than that, because healthcare embodies a whole other realm of services that really extends even to social service needs. Because if somebody does not have housing, somebody does not have transportation, that affects either their ability to access or get care or participate in care. So we have those that are direct providers, and I think what you're talking about is what are all those indirect providers that make healthcare feasible for
Yeah, I guess the line would be more on the healthcare.
Right.
Well, okay, an indirect provider, an in-care home, an in-care worker, is that a provider?
Yes, you have both type of home health care would be considered to me a medical provider.
Okay.
But you also have in-home assistance with daily living activities that might not necessarily be considered direct health care. They're just helping somebody that is unable to take care of themselves with daily living activities.
I guess what I'm kind of looking at are people who are compensated in some way by someone for providing a health care
service,
yeah.
Right.
And anyway, and so as we talked earlier, if we're going to devise a new system, we have to very carefully survey who's out there and who is going to be in and who's going to be out in terms of compensation and what the impact will be on the people that they deal with. So, thank you.
Good. What I wanted to spend a few minutes on was simply talking about some of the non-traditional services that you might not think of when you think of a health plan. And I provided a list of just some of the projects that we are involved in as an organization. DOCS as an organization began a weight management program about 4 years ago now. I don't know if you're aware that obesity is not a covered condition right now on the Oregon Health Plan. It certainly affects the health condition of a lot of people. And so we recognized that and started our own exercise nutrition program as a local benefit to those members who are obese and need assistance in losing weight and addressing their activity skills. I point this out, as I'm going to point out a couple other things, that it is our community's decision to do those things that benefit us here locally. And as the others I'm going to talk about, I think that is the real plus to our organization, and it's kind of the hidden benefit.
Have you noticed, and I don't know how long you've been doing that, have you noticed any impact on diabetes as a result of that?
Yes, we have numerous individuals that have been very successful with our program that have had a significant reduction in medication requirements, just daily lifestyle, diabetes, asthma. Their conditions have improved remarkably just due to primarily the loss of weight.
Well, and the change in lifestyle and change in diet.
Being activity,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, because chronic conditions are a key driver, and so I think that's important.
Part of that.
Yeah. Are you going to go through any of these, or can I ask a question about one of them?
I would either, Senator Montesanison, at your request, I would do either.
Okay, well, I'm curious about the Access Nurse, and you say it's a national nurse call service. Tell me a little bit about that.
In a small community like ours, and earlier you heard testimony about recruiting and retaining physicians, one of the things we strive to do as an organization is to take as much burden off the physicians and providers as we can. So we have actually contracted, there are several well-known national nurse call systems, which is basically a dial a nurse at any time, day or night. You can call and speak to a registered nurse, licensed nurse, and discuss a medical issue. And we don't limit that discussion to, geez, you can only ask about this or this or this. They can call, they can ask questions about, they saw their doctor today and they want to talk to somebody else about it. They want to know if a diaper rash is really an emergency and should I go to the emergency room. It's all of those types of things that allow them to speak almost immediately with an individual privately and to get almost immediate feedback. That alleviates the pressure in part on physicians' offices and also in part on the emergency room by hopefully avoiding non-emergent visits that actually would have shown up there. So 24/7, 365, 1-800 number, no cost to our members.
And just to follow up, then what if there are other people, could they access that even though they're not a member?
They actually do have our eligibility, so they can see who is on our plan.
Okay.
We have said always answer the question. It's our choice as the contractor to say either you can turn them off or turn them on, but we are a community organization, and if they got it from their sister that's on the Oregon Health Plan, we want to be able to provide as much service in our community as we can.
How much does that cost?
We pay a fixed amount, and then if our call volume exceeds a certain level, there's an incremental amount that we pay if we have extremely high call volumes. I could get you the details of the exact cost.
I would like to know that.
Yeah, I would too. That sounds like a pretty good thing.
So I think the state actually has followed our lead and recently implemented a call system. I believe DHS has a program now where they've started to do that.
Okay.
My daughter-in-law in Sebastopol or Cotati, California, is a nurse working for Kaiser Permanente who does that. That's her job,
right?
To answer those kinds of calls. Go through the rest of them.
Okay. We were also instrumental, I think, in helping start the school-based health center that we have here at Marshfield. Once again, following up on the discussion about the need to have multiple access to care, multiple routes, we had worked with the school district. We actually funded a nursing position to actually do the investigation into establishing a school-based health clinic, which is now up and running. It is being administered by Waterfall Clinic, and we are very supportive of that program, Waterfall Clinic, which is a nurse practitioner clinic, as well as supporting the Powers Clinic, which is a nurse practitioner clinic also. Unfortunately, Powers Clinic does not have a provider at this time, just recently lost its nurse practitioner. They're still looking to recruit, but we've been very supportive of those type of programs. Another program that I think is important to our community is that Bay Area Hospital, Coos County Mental Health, Coos County Health Department, other organizations came together to create what we call a community case manager position and program. And what that position really is a case manager to manage all the case managers. And each of our organizations, we provide case management. The issue is coordinating that case management and making sure a member follows through with all those recommendations. So we have put one person over top of all of that, and the rule of participation is if that person calls and says, I need this for this member, we drop everything. These people that are enrolled in the program are those that are high utilizers, frequently accessing more than one type of service, not just healthcare. And we feel by all working together collectively in our community that we actually improve the outcome for that individual as well as lowering costs. And that has been a very successful program for us. The real limitation right now is just the number of cases that that individual can, you know, manage at one point in time. But we've seen reductions in ER visits. We've seen improvement in compliance. It's been a great success for our community. Along that same line, a more recent program is the guardianship program, where we have worked with the court systems and the same group of individuals have come together to try and expedite cases where an individual doesn't have a family member, doesn't have anybody looking out for them, and really becomes unable of making their own decisions. So instead of letting them linger at any one place in the healthcare system till the legal issues get resolved, we have worked with the court system to expedite that process and to have a named guardian appointed as soon as possible. Coos Elderly Services, a local nonprofit, is the entity that's actually administering that program for us. The other point I'd like to make, and I think I will have covered most of them on here then, is that as an organization, we have created what we call an exception fund. The Oregon Health Plan has many rules and regulations and what's covered and what's not covered. Our issue with that is that we have to deal with the person that's sitting right in front of us or the doctor that's coming to us and saying, that rule doesn't make any sense. And unfortunately, a lot of times we have to agree that rule doesn't make any sense, but it was there because of financial reasons and the underlying desire of the Oregon Health Plan to provide as much services to as many people and not cover everything. But we have created a fund where we will look at those cases that are extraordinary and where we believe that providing service, even though it might not be a covered service, is really in the long-term best effort, best benefit to our community, and usually lowers costs. A very simple example of that is we had a child who had lodged an object in his ear. You can diagnose that he has an object in his ear, but removing that object from his ear is below the line and not covered. It makes no sense to leave that object in the ear and allow it to become infected or to have other adverse outcomes. So those are the types of things where we will go ahead and choose to pay, in this case, for the removal of the object because it makes long-term sense to both the member and to our financial bottom line.
The viability grant that we are proposing as part of our Measure 37 would take care, I think, of the nurse practitioner in Powell. What could you give me some information about that situation in Powell?
Powers.
I'm sorry.
I think
Powers is right over the top of the hill. Right?
It's a long ways from here, and I've been there many times.
Okay, but that within your.
It's in Coos County. It's at the far end of Coos County.
And, yeah, tell me a little bit more about that.
I think the primary issue is simply recruiting a practitioner to that rural part of Coos County.
Yeah. And remote. Very
rural and remote.
Well.
Is it a funding issue, though?
I think in part it may be a funding issue, although we and others have worked very closely with actually supporting funding for that position. So I would answer that question by the fact that we didn't get a call and said, if you give us more money, it'll solve the problem. We haven't gotten that call yet. I think it's more of a recruiting issue at this point in time.
But they're fortunate, Coos County is fortunate to have your organization that is well organized. Other counties, rural counties, are not as fortunate. And what we're looking at in our bill is to be able to provide grant money for places that need that kind of assistance.
Just so you know, Mr. Chair, just to have kind of perspective, Powers is about a half hour away on a very windy road from the major metropolitan center of Myrtle Point.
That if they can get to Myrtle Point, then they're halfway there, right?
And the road slides in very out of.
Well, and then you got to go over the other way.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, Ed Patterson, I'm sure, will talk about that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Good afternoon, and thank you for permitting me to be before you. My name is Chris Flamang.
Flamang.
Okay. Yes.
Got it.
And I'm I am a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. However, for purposes today, I'm speaking as a citizen of Coos County, private citizen of Coos County, who does some advocating in of various arenas.
Well, now, just a minute. Well, you do have permission to speak as a member of the Governor's Commission. You are allowed to lobby the legislature. We've cleared that up
with John.
Yes, Mr. Chair, he has done that.
No, yes. But really, I mean, there was this kind of thing going on there for a while about whether or not you guys could actually. And I am a member also.
Yes,
of,
you are.
The group, and so you are representing the group, and I want you to speak with authority.
We will do that. And speaking along those lines, Dr. Goldberg, the director of Department of Human Services, spoke in his first conversation with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, which I'll refer to with the acronym GCSS. And he said something that I found to be stimulating and profound. He used the term that we should all become absolute advocates. And so in that spirit, I'm going to be talking with you today. Living in a rural small community like we do in the rural area has both advantages and disadvantages, of course. And it's really important, the function that this committee is doing, to come out and to see and hear some of the situations that are being faced by folks that live in rural Oregon. I do want to state my fundamental belief that in an enlightened country, technologically advanced, with a major player on an international stage, my belief is that the members of that society have a right to adequate health care. And the manner in which we can provide that, of course, gets off into a lot of other avenues. But I want to state that as a basic fundamental of my approach today. And I'm not going to try to chase down the avenues that the professionals have talked to you about health care in and the current Bill 37 that is being considered. But rather, I want to move into three particular areas that I would like to talk to you about. And the first one is the area of mental health. And as I approach rapidly the fact that I'm going to have to learn that term octogenarian very, very, very soon, I probably represent a person who can trace my travels back into the Dark Ages. And those Dark Ages include some things that occurred in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and on. And so I want to mention to you that overlooked considerably in our society has been mental health issues amongst older Americans. And when I say that, we're talking primarily people probably 60, 65 and upward. Now, in the wisdom of the legislature, 2005, you did pass Senate Bill 781. And Senate Bill 781 included then the older Oregonian population as a separate group within the laws governing and rules governing the mental health at the county level, the mental health departments and delivery service. So that in the past it was adults or children, and so now it's children, adults, and older citizens. We're at the stage now where we're probably moving toward implementation of Senate Bill 781. And the Governor's Commission, along with some other entities, mental health entities, the Governor's Commission is in the process of supporting a proposal that would bring about a geriatric mental health certification training program through a pilot program to be established in five counties, two of which would be urban or large population areas, and three would be rural areas. Those have not been selected. They would be selected as a result of the implementation of this. The program for the delivery of such training would be to existing practitioners by giving them the necessary training to then focus on the needs of dealing with the geriatric population. It's based on a program that is successful and has been operated, a evidence-based program, by the way, in the state of Washington, and it is expected to be adapted to the needs of Oregon. 20 such trainees would go through the program, at least 20 within the proposal. And also, it would serve as a center for consultation and assistance to any mental health unit at the county levels throughout Oregon. We have, with the burgeoning boomer population, it's estimated now that we're going to probably double psychiatric problems amongst persons 65 and over within the next 20 years. Right now, of course, we think in terms of catastrophic Alzheimer's and other dementia problems, but we also have the mental health problems associated with mental illness, such as bipolar disorders, etc., and the major area that is not being addressed very well by society of drug and alcohol addiction. And it's interesting to note that as the boomers enter the older American population, some of them were at Woodstock, and some of them are still at Woodstock. And when you add on top of that the physical problems of aging, then even the person who may have successfully controlled their addiction may be exposed to re-addiction, so that we could be facing something that is significantly serious and we're not prepared for it. And it's very possible that this particular proposal that will be coming to the legislature this session will in many ways be the starting point to try to answer some of the mental health issues amongst the older population. And just as a quick example, if you're 85 and a white male, you probably are highly susceptible to elderly suicide, another function that is not being addressed and not being talked about in the national dialogue. So, with that, I would like to then turn to a second problem that I've enumerated for you in my handout. And that second problem is dental care for children in foster homes. And what I'm not saying this is statewide, but I am saying it is a particular problem that has surfaced in Coos County. And this is not in any way intended to denigrate the dental community. That's not the intention here at all. This is to give you some facts that are not well known that relate to these children who are the victims mostly of child abuse, child neglect, and or unsafe parenting practices and home practices, who have been removed and placed under the wardship of the state of Oregon through the Department of Human Services. As a foster parent, they go to get a dental appointment, and they oftentimes encounter a situation where they are told the only way they can get that with that Oregon card for that child is if a patient cancels. which means they get notified sometimes the morning of the day of the appointment to be there. Then they go into the juggling act of trying to get a kid out of school, et cetera, and all these other things to be able to get to the dental's office. Now, if they get there late, or if they otherwise miss that appointment, they're put on the bottom of the list, and they go to the far bottom of the waiting list. Now, the thing is that most of those kids come into shelter care with a very bad dental and health history. The medical community does a really good job in Coos County in those services. But those of us that serve on the Civilian Review Board and reviewing these cases, when we read the files, we find that 1.5 to 2.5 to 4 years, and the child has been in wardship, but has never been seen by a dentist. And it's because they can't get the appointments effectively. And I do not know the solution to that, but I think that somehow by dealing with the Oregon Dental Association and all, that's certainly the profession will be able to at least give some guidelines to move forward to overcome that kind of a problem. My assumption, although I don't know it, is that this does exist in other rural areas in the state of Oregon. But I do know it does exist in Coos County. Lastly, then, there's another situation that I find disturbing, and I discovered this very, very quickly. I was a active law enforcement officer for many years. I am a retired emeritus professor of police training from the University of Illinois, and I have trained and dealt with police officers and law enforcement throughout the United States. I'm the author of a 1970, a text on the police role in underprotected children, which is child abuse and neglect. I was the law enforcement representative selected by C. Henry Kempe and Ray Helfer, who were, at the time, they were the professors of pediatrics at the University of Colorado Medical School in Denver. And they were the leaders in child abuse at that time. In fact, Kempe is the guy who coined the term battered child syndrome. And I was invited as the law enforcement representative to a working seminar that developed the diagnostic and treatment center named after Kempe now at the University of Denver's Medical School for child abuse and neglect. And with this background, I'm aware of criminal records checks. And where I'm going with this is the relationship to the fitness for people to become caregivers in our homes for both our disabled persons with disabilities and for our elderly population, which the enlightened state of Oregon has kept out of the long-term care facility by primarily supporting people who need assistance with daily living in their home and by keeping a large group of people still independent. But what I'm discovering recently is because home care or caregiver is an occupation that has a fairly decent salary range compared to the minimum wage. A lot of folks are starting to enter that arena. And some of those folks are known to the Department of Human Services for child abuse and neglect. Some of those folks have founded cases within DHS. Some of those folks have had their children removed. Some of those folks have had their parental rights terminated.
for child abuse and neglect in their own families, and they may be moving now into home care with some of our more vulnerable people. And because of the rules of confidentiality, when you make a records check on somebody, you're not touching that base at all, because they were not charged with a crime and they were not prosecuted in many instances. And what we're suggesting here is the notion that somehow for purposes of that kind of unsupervised home care or caregiving, that maybe some of that DHS confidentiality needs to be altered to the extent that it can be in, those facts can be included by the people who are running these records checks.
Okay, I will add something. Yesterday I sat in a meeting with DHS, Ramona Foley, Bob Nickel, and representatives of Scar Jasper Mountain. Are you familiar with that facility?
Yes, I am.
It is
yes,
one of
I
the
am.
Most severely abused. They have had a problem in licensing. They've withheld their license for a facility because they have an individual who the department said there's evidence of abuse. Dave Ziegler from Scar Jasper Mountain has been fighting this battle for 3 months and said, we don't have that evidence. Dave Ziegler received that evidence 2 days ago. They immediately put that person on administrative leave, and they're starting termination hearings. The glitch is that there was no way that the agency could tell them that they had evidence that Dave Ziegler didn't have. And that was that's going to change. I mean, based on the meeting that we had yesterday there, that was an interesting situation, that they had the evidence, but they couldn't say anything about it.
Right.
Now, that has to change, and I think it will change because of this situation.
Well, I'm not certain, but currently, Senate Bill 61, which relates to the Oregon Commission for Volunteer Activities, and I think it sits over in the Department of, I'm not sure exactly which department, but it does exist, and I'm not very familiar with it, but I see Senator Cruz.
That's a bill that we have.
We passed those out of our committee.
Right. I don't know that we passed 61. We passed 60.
We did.
Okay. Well, we did pass
61. 61.
Okay.
Ask them to set standards.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Now, it could be that that might include this kind of a thing. Also, House Bill 2175 is authorizing Department of Human Services to use abuse and neglect reports to determine fitness of employees and volunteers that provide services. Now, I'm not saying it goes as far as what I'm talking about for caregivers, but at least it might be some place where you'd have an avenue to at least look at this, trying to solve this dilemma.
Sure. And it's not a broad-based solution, but the department does have a sensitive review process that allows the appropriate people to look into these, the confidentiality screen is in place. And we are looking currently at ways to trigger that process from the outside.
Yes.
So if we hear some anecdotal stuff, legislators can make a request. And plus we've raised the level of awareness inside the department of this. So that's a way to deal with it and still protect confidentiality. So,
well, there will be a rule change based on the meeting that we had yesterday. That definitely is going to happen. Now, that deals with licensing of an agency, but it also deals with the department being able to implement the information that they have that is confidential. And if there's not that connection, then what good is that information?
That's right. Okay. Thank you. And I'd like to thank each senator, the committee administrator, for having come down here and met with us here in Coos County, and again for allowing me an opportunity to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's rather late in the game, but we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 37, and we will call Ed Patterson to come up and give us the
overview.
Now, we wanted to touch on this today, not in great detail. It did bring a slide show, thank God. We're going to have that on Monday. And we will go into great detail on Monday and have a public hearing on this bill, and hopefully we will move it out
if we
and successfully implement the bill. But because it does have ramifications for everybody in this room, we want to talk about it. So, Ed,
Mr. Chair, yes. I apologize, but I need to head back, and I want to thank the people of Coos Bay and North Bend for having us here. And I've really learned a lot, and hopefully we're going to be taking some of your suggestions and make so that it will make a difference and help you in this region. Anyway, thank you very much.
You gave them both to you. I know. Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm representing the Oregon Rural Health Association, of which I am the executive director. And let me take this opportunity on behalf of 750 individual members of our association and 50 organizational members to take and thank you, too, especially for the strong support of rural health. You have both been always there for rural health, and we appreciate it very much. And I'm sure you'll be ready for this bill because you passed this bill out in the same form 2 years ago. And I'm going to describe it, and I had some handouts for those who want them. I'm not going to describe the bill itself, but just as one pager that I put together that describes the bill in language we can understand, hopefully. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill does have a policy statement in the lead paragraph, and the policy statement is fairly unusual in legislation, but I have used it before, and it seems to come in handy when legislators get in the mood to cut the legislation or unfund the legislation. Make this policy statement say that a sustainable rural health program is very important to the state of Oregon because the downstate sometimes is a big target. As an example, all three of these programs that I'm going to be discussing have been funded in the past but have lost funding. They're not new ideas. There's some that you two put together in a road trip we made many years ago over in eastern Oregon and down here on the coast. The bill basically does four things. It puts the policy statement together for use, future use by legislators and those who advocate for rural health. First thing it does is provide assistance to rural emergency medical services. Some years ago, we put together a program to assist volunteer EMTs to get free education and training. They were paying for the cost of their training out of their own pockets. Recently, we have had a number of comments from some of the rural parts of the state that they couldn't recruit EMTs, volunteer EMTs anymore, because they just flat couldn't afford it. And I think we all understand that the economics are a little different in the rural parts of the state. And so this would provide some assistance, financial assistance, to the area health education centers around the state to set up training programs for EMTs that they don't have to pay for, that the monies that we allocate to this side would pay for that. And we think that will help solve the problem of recruiting volunteers, EMTs. The second thing it does for emergency medical services, it provides half of the funds that are allocated to EMS will be for grant money so that these emergency medical service agencies in the rural parts of the state don't have to depend on cake sales to raise money to buy important equipment or ambulances because some of them are hard-pressed for the cities or counties or jurisdictions to provide the funds for this. We had several years ago we carved out money from the, I think it's called criminal fund and assistance monies that the crime, I can't recall the exact name, but it's if a criminal is caught and fined, the money goes into a pot, and the state legislature manages that pot, and it goes to fund all sorts of judicial positions and other sorts of things. We made the case that EMS is also, emergency services is also a public safety issue. And so for two biennia, we had the funds to take care and fund this program. And then back in, I think it was either 01 or 03, the money was taken out for creating some judicial positions, and that was the policy decision that was made. But that money was really highly sought after and used very well for 4 years. It purchased everything from ambulances to telephones and radios.
Mr. Chair, I think there was a direct correlation between that money going there and the fact that Gene Kims was co-chair of Ways and Means, but that's...
Well, now that he's no longer a senator, he was another outstanding supporter of rural health.
Yes, he was.
The second thing it does is increases access to rural primary care providers through rural health clinics. We have about 40 rural health clinics in the state, and those 40 receive no federal assistance. The other safety net clinics, so-called safety net clinics, receive federal monies, operating monies, for their operations. There are the 40 rural health clinics, about half of them, I think 20 of them, are either district clinics that receive some subsidies through property taxes. Some are publicly owned, either by cities or counties. But some of them are just very, very small, and some of them are very remote in the state. Sometimes they may be staffed by a single nurse practitioner or single physician assistant, and they don't have enough paying patients to maintain their viability. And I'm thinking of one particularly in Christmas Valley, which is over in eastern Oregon, very remote, 100 miles from the next closest town. They, for years, had struggled with providing a nurse practitioner to run their shop. Finally, there was an active board created, and they appointed, they were able to pass some property tax subsidies over in that part of the state to kind of stabilize their clinic. They are able to pay a physician once every 2 weeks to come over and verify the practices at the clinic, which is required by law. We had, in I think it was 2003, there was $3 million left over of a safety net clinic budget that was transferred over to the 03 legislature. And that was identified for support of rural clinics.
Mm-hmm. And promises by everybody, if you remember it.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
But you remember that, Senator.
Yes.
And amazingly enough, in the last week of the legislative session, the $3 million disappeared and went to some other person's priority, but not to the rural safety net clinics. And those things happen. But the money was there, and it had good intentions, but the clinics never received the money. So we think that the clinics need to have that money if we're going to keep them alive and viable in the rural parts of the state. So this allocates funds for the Office of Rural Health to provide grant money, operational money, and other services to the rural health clinics.
This is kind of the first step in our universal health plan in many ways, and I think it's absolutely essential for you to be talking to the Rural Health Reform, not the Rural Health, but the Healthcare Reform Committee. These are the providers in rural Oregon that we have to take care of. That's where we build a program. We build a program from the bottom up, and this is the bottom. I mean, they're the ones who, I don't mean the bottom like they are the forgotten ones, but they're the foundation is what I should say. These are the foundations for rural health, for health care in Oregon.
I agree.
And I think that we need to present that, to the Reform Committee so they get a sense of where we have to, the people we need to include. I can't imagine a universal health plan in Christmas Valley without including that clinic.
Senator, I think you're absolutely correct. And I think... I know you talked to the leader of the Office of Rural Health yesterday with me, and I think he's very interested in doing something like that and would like to get in on the activities of that committee.
Well, Ilana, I think is going to schedule you guys.
She
has total control over that.
Amazing.
The third issue for a sustainable rural health plan is the funding of the Rural Health Viability Grant Program that you folks passed several years ago using tobacco settlement money. We managed to carve out, in the end, $15 million of that, and was in the bill. The bill was passed. But then the leadership never turned the money loose. So although there was $15 million approved, it was saved to the next session and spent on something
else. That was that MUPPO money, wasn't it?
That was the MUPPO money.
MUPPO money. Yes, it was.
Oh, okay.
It was MUPPO money. Imagine spending that on health care. Who would have thought?
That was health care money spent on everything but health care, and so we have to pay it back to the feds. And there was an opportunity to do something right that we didn't. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Anyway, as you know, and I want the audience to know, that there are 30, I think either 33 or 36 small rural hospitals classified as type A or B hospitals in the state. Many of those hospitals were created by Hill Burton funds back in the 1950s after World War II. We had an expanding population. Some of those hospitals are now 60, 70 years old, and because they have difficulty raising the capital to modernize the hospitals or rebuild the hospitals, they're just falling apart. Our association put together a study of those, most of those rural hospitals several years ago. We hired an architect with some grant money, went and reviewed all those hospitals that wanted us to be reviewed. Two of those hospitals that were reviewed were the ones in Enterprise and in Burns. They were the smallest and I think probably the oldest, and the architect identified them as the most in need. Neither one of the boards over in those two communities realized that they really had some problems with the physical plants that they had over there. Both, after many efforts and requests to receive money for assistance, finally had the wherewithal to get a feasibility study done and take the feasibility study and get the financing to build the hospitals. Those hospitals weren't going to be opening up. New hospitals in those two communities are going to be opening up this year. They're almost completed now, will be opening. And I haven't seen them myself, but I've heard back that they are going to be really fine facilities. And on your tour, you toured both of those hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's that kind of leadership that needs to be provided. There are still several other hospitals out there that need to either be renovated or modernized or equipment purchased. So with the grant program already in session laws, we would use those as guidelines to fund the program again and hopefully get the money from the tobacco revenue that's available in the state to get that program moving, not just for rural hospitals, but other innovative ideas for recruiting physicians or health care providers or whatever is needed out there. So those are the three pieces that I think are most important to maintain a foundation, Senator Morissette, as you call it, in the rural parts of the state. And we hope, I feel certain that you'll pass the bill out of committee, but I hope we can get the legislature and the Ways and Means Committee and the leadership to support it. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might raise.
Where is Sumter? This is a quiz.
Where is Sumter?
Sumter, I found it on the map. We visited Baker City, and then we went up through the mountains and arrived at Sumter, which is a very nice little community. We met in City Hall, and the only paid employee, I think, was the city recorder. And we met where they have two ambulances, and they finance their ambulances with a bake sale every year during their big Sumter Days
festival. Yeah.
And that's what they use for their health care funding, which is absurd. And during the winter time, when the roads are impassable and hunters go back there and they get stuck and so on, these volunteers, I think they're level one basically, and they go in and stabilize, and then they have to have somebody probably fly in sometimes. It's pathetic that we have to fund this basic health care with a bake sale.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of things. Number one, I want to thank Ed for going over all of the masterful plans you and I have had over the years that have come on rocks.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding us.
Thanks for reminding us of our failures. We appreciate that. And, Mr. Chair, I think of because we did in 2000, we took, as Senator Fisher and me at that time, were the chairs of the Joint Human Service Committee, and we did two tours, one of Eastern Oregon and one of the coast. And And it was so incredibly enlightening to everybody that was there. I'm not sure, Ed, but are Bill and I the only two that are left?
Didn't Jerry Crummell go?
Crummell.
Okay. Yeah, but he's a House member, so he doesn't count. Yeah. And so,
Jerry Crummell is, and the two of us.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and we considered.
That was a life-changing experience for me. I mean, as far as my focus on health care, that really, really, really made a difference.
And he has been such a strong advocate. Senator Morissette has been such a strong advocate for rural health that, I mean, it's just been a joy to work
rural,
with him.
Rural health and tsunamis.
Senator, I know you told me not to talk about financing today because I'm going to talk about financing this program on Monday when I testify before your committee. But the point I would make is that, and I know you can know this, but just for the audience's sake, it takes so little money to really make huge improvements. And I'll be proposing to you to use tobacco revenue. And it only takes 2.3% of all the tobacco revenue that the state receives. Excuse me, I forgot to turn that
off. Oh, I forgot to announce. Please turn your cell phones off.
You're just lucky Senator Walker's not here. You'd be
I know. But it only takes 2.3% of all the $355 million a year the state receives to solve these problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you know that, and I just hope we can convince the rest of the members to know how smoke really
well,
is.
I think we have the majority of the committee right here, don't we?
Yeah,
we're okay.
Thank you for allowing me
to. Thank you for being here. And Monday is Rural Health Day.
Rural Oregon Day.
Rural Oregon. I'm sorry. Monday is Rural Oregon Day in the Capitol, and we are going to hear the bill and have a full-scale presentation, and you will be able to show your slides.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, indeed.
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
Good. Well, thank you again for inviting us. And Nikki, you've made an impact on my consciousness, certainly, and we will await your summary reminder of the issues. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 37 and close the meeting. We are adjourned. Thank you.